It's a great lesson for us because they're behaving very different than the previous generation.
This man is the brain behind 3,800 finance departments across 50 states. So naturally, he was the perfect person to ask what's next for the car market. Today on the Car Dealership Guy podcast, I'm joined by Scott Gunnell, president of JM&A Group. Before we get into the show, this episode is brought to you by Wide Whale, the auto industry's trust marketing platform. Wide Whale is the reputation engine behind thousands of dealers, including Lithia, Koons, Westhurst, Swickard, Herb Chambers, and many more. AI is here to stay, and Wide Whale is ready to help you take advantage. With brand new AI topic analysis tools, you can give structure to free text customer reviews. This allows you to reveal opportunities for improvement according to the voice of your customers like never before. Wide Whale AI analyzes every review to compile frequently mentioned topics. Paired with ratings and sentiment, your quarterly reports will go from "we have a 4.4 rating on Google" to "our customers think wait time at our dealership is 30% worse than industry benchmarks." Now that's actionable insight. Wide Whale is the fastest growing reputation management vendor in automotive. You can learn more by visiting widewheel.com or clicking the link in the show notes below. This episode is also brought to you by Upstart. Upstart partners with dealers to digitize and connect their online, in-store, and financing process to create the car buying experience today's customers expect. Backed by trusted OEMs, Upstart helps dealers sell more cars efficiently, speeding up processes to boost profits and enhance customer satisfaction. With integrated finance capabilities powered by AI technology, Upstart's connected platform enables consumers to shop from anywhere, then seamlessly transition in-store and complete the deal digitally, creating a hassle-free purchase path that benefits both dealers and buyers. For a brighter car buying future, visit upstart.com/dealers. That's upstart.com/dealers, or click the link in the show notes below. Scott Gunnell on the CDG podcast. Scott, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I feel very privileged to be on the show today.
I think our conversation before I pressed record could have been a podcast on its own.
Yeah, I would agree. It's great to get to know you. And thank you for what you're doing for the industry, for consumers, for the business. I mean, I'm a huge fan.
Appreciate you. I'm glad we were finally able to make this. It's funny because some of the best conversations actually do happen like right before I press record. And so sometimes I'll just press record and I just tell the guests, hey, like the episode is just going to fade in. Don't even worry about it because you just kind of kick it off organically. And so it's always fun. Anywho, great to have you on the show. I want to kick off with your background, who you are, how you got into this business. So start us off with there, right? Tell us about your background and your start in the car business.
So I am second generation in the car business. My father got started in the car business in the early 70s. He's an accountant by background. And so he was actually hired into JM Family very early on in the history of the organization, working directly for Mr. Moran. He and I never overlapped in our careers here, but growing up, I was always a car enthusiast. I would say I was always a people person. You know, anecdotally, I was Dennis the Menace as a child. I mean, literally a nickname that I had, just being very curious. And a lot of my curiosity lent itself around cars. While in college, I had the entrepreneurial spirit, and I was at Florida State University in Tallahassee. And one of my friends who I went to high school with, who was a couple years younger, we did our version of a market study to realize like what business could we get into that has low startup costs, that doesn't have a lot of competition. And there was not a contracting valet parking company that existed in Tallahassee, Florida at the time. There was a restaurant that had their own valet in-house, but there wasn't a contracting valet parking company. And so I literally had a 1999, I think it was at the time, 4Runner that I sold, bought a 1993 Mustang, and I took the difference between the cost of the two, and we started the valet parking company. And as young individual entrepreneurs, I would say we got a very healthy dose of reality of what it means to be in business.
What were the key lessons for you back then?
Well, the first key lesson was just around risk. I mean, at Valley Parking Company, I'm insuring somebody to drive somebody else's car. And cars are very expensive and there's a lot of risk associated with it. And we happen to have a AMG Mercedes stolen from one of our accounts. This is actually an interesting story. And I'll share with you the story. It was a young entrepreneur himself. Now, at the time, I was probably 20 or 21, I think, if I go back in memory. And he was probably around 30. And he had started a business in the rental real estate space. And so he just started making some money. He buys this prized possession, this Mercedes, and it gets stolen from our account. And thankfully, we recovered the vehicle. But what we didn't recover were the vehicle, were the keys. And so we had to have the car rekeyed. And back in this day, it was still like $6,000 to get this car rekeyed. I couldn't imagine what it costs today. But this gentleman was very, very assertive. He was threatening our company. He was threatening us with lawsuits. He was threatening our reputation. And I couldn't get him to slow down. And so ultimately, I finally said, look, can you meet with me in person? And he was willing to do that. I show up in his office and he sees how young I am. And the first thing when I walked in was like, wait, you're the owner of the business? And I said, yeah. And he took this like giant step back and he was like, as an entrepreneur himself, he said, tell me about this. And so I explained to him a little bit about the business. And I basically explained to him, I said, the threats that you're putting are going to put me out of business. I won't survive this. So I'm just a young gentleman, just like you, trying to learn. And clearly we have failures in our process that I promise you I'm going to correct. But if we can get to some amicable resolution here, I'll stay in business and I promise I will fix this problem. And the reason I share that element of the story with you, because getting into the car business and selling cars, that learning experience was critical. Getting to the win-win. As you know, a lot of customers come into dealerships and they're not necessarily in the most open-minded, amicable state of mind. But getting people to work their way down into a trusting situation where they understand that I'm committed to their best interest and they can be open-minded with me. And so that Valley Parking brought me a lot of lessons. We ultimately sold the business. I had a pocket full of cash. I wouldn't say we sold it for any astounding amount of money, but as a young gentleman, I was able to employ a lot of my friends. I was able to learn a lot about people and really got a heavy dose. I left that and knew I wanted to get the car business. And so with a college degree, I went and started selling cars. And that was a lesson in its own, because back at that point in time, and similar to some of today, but you were working 6 days a week at a minimum, one Sunday off a month. If you took your day off and somebody showed up, you know, it was a half deal, lost deal, very traditional in the business. And so, you know, it was a heavy dose of reality for me, because, you know, a lot of my friends are graduate college and they're working 9-to-5 jobs and they want me to join their softball team or they want me to go on the concert on the weekend and I'm working. And there was a direct correlation between the amount of time I worked at that point and the success I had. So I sold cars at a Toyota store down here in South Florida for about a year and a half. There was a point in that my entrepreneurial spirit came out again and I became a used car wholesaler.
Really? I didn't see that one. And I did some digging.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, you're right. Maybe I should be a little bit more public about that. But another learning, I would say the learning was, A, I got ahead of myself in what I thought I was capable of with limited experience in the business to do this. And B, I learned, you know, the school of hard knocks around used car wholesaling. At the auction, the first car I ever bought had a ton of paint damage that I didn't see. I mean, literally, the first car I bought on the lane, ton of paint damage I didn't see. And I remember the partner I had was like, you know, I taught you everything and you made the cardinal mistake on the first vehicle. But I did that for a period of time, about 6 months, and realized that, you know, that was a good learning, but it wasn't necessarily for me. And I went back to selling cars and then ultimately got hired on by JM to get F&I experience. So there at the point in time, JM didn't have any entry-level positions. If you didn't have experience, I had car sale experience. There was no jobs available on the Toyota side. And so there was an opportunity to go in F&I. And so I shipped over to the West Coast of Florida to do F&I.
You know, I love your story because while I wouldn't call EQ something that's underrated in our industry, it's absolutely not underrated, but it's just so important. And when you, as you were saying that story, I was thinking about all those times as well, right? Where, you know, there's a situation and you just sit with the person 101, you know, just talk and you ultimately, right? Like what's driving them, especially with an angry customer, right? Which, you know, everyone gets those here and there, and you have to just neutralize that and figure out like, how do you fix it? And I've said this before in the podcast, but like we used to have a saying called T-Mobile voice, which really was our version of pretty much saying, right, like unemotionally, right, listen to the person, empathize, and try to get to the bottom of the situation. Like where is the middle ground? How do you fix this? And so, I mean, I used to run these sprints with our team where any bad review we would get, right, for whatever reason, I mean, it could have literally been someone 3 months later had an unexpected repair, whatever it is, we would like just go out of our way to actually call that customer, fix the, try to, if it made sense, to fix that issue unconditionally. And then after that, we would tell them we would appreciate if they would update their review to reflect the changes or, you know, the experience. It's not mandatory, obviously, but if they would be open to that, we would appreciate it. I got to tell you, like 80+% of people update it, and not everyone changes the stars, and which is fine, but like they would update, say like, you know, update, this happened, I'm so happy now, and blah, blah, blah. And so anyways, just like my two cents, right? That EQ combined with a little bit of empathy goes a long way in the business world, clearly, as you know, and as we both know. Now, fast forward us, you've had a just astonishing career at JM Family, or JM&A Group, sorry, 14 years, if I'm not mistaken, or 13 years and 10 months. You are now the president of the company. Give us an overview, right, of what is JM&A Group. Give us just like a short overview of what do you do.
So let me give you a little context. I'm in my 21st year with JM Family. You're correct in how long I've been at JM&A. JM Family is a privately held organization. We own the distributor for Toyota in the five Southeast states. We own the captive finance company, Southeast Toyota Finance, that supports those 177 dealers in the five Southeast states. And then JM&A Group, which is a nationwide entity that does business in the finance and insurance space. So my career at JM&A really started, most of my career has been in the sales side of the business. Up until 2020, I had all sales and strategy-based roles. But a lot of my career was, you know, we were founded, Mr. Moran founded us on the premise of dealer centricity, on the premise of if we help dealers solve problems, they will sell more cars. They will sell more parts on the Toyota side. They will finance more vehicles. And in our case, they will sell more of our products. So it's a win-win scenario. And a lot of my role at JM&A has been to really understand the needs of the market, understand the needs of our field team, the needs of our internal associates, the needs of our dealers, and to try and marry strategies that blend together in order to provide better solutions for our dealer customers. And then, you know, part of that journey was also learning the operational elements and operations specific to JM&A. As we have a product development team, we have a claims team that, you know, obviously adjudicates all the claims for all of our products. We have an actuarial team. We have a lot of internal departments that really make this engine work. And there's a lot of complexity to our business. So the last several years before becoming president was really understanding the inner workings of the operation so I could be effective at connecting the dealer, the associate, the market, our product offering, our operations to have a universe of, you know, hopefully success in the way we see the market from our high touch, high value offering.
When it comes to financing at a dealership today, right, what are you seeing? What is the most popular, call it version or process of the financing dealership process? What is that like today that you're seeing nationwide?
What I would say it's like today is it would start with a very defined process. And so definition is very key. There's multiple versions of a process, but I would say the most successful version is one that's defined with early manager involvement. So where the F&I managers are involved both outside the store, so with whatever digital activity that the consumer is doing, they're aware of that. And then very involved when the consumer gets into the store. And so specifically with that involvement, it's really understanding the customer's motivations. It's understanding, you know, what their hot buttons are, what their desires are. And it's really leveraging the salesperson or the other dealership associates, because there's with early involvement, you have a quicker transfer of trust. And that's really, really important from an F&I perspective, because if I could just take a second and define F&I, right? F is the finance side. So it's the assimilation of funds, whether it's a loan, it's collecting a payment, it's, you know, collecting, if it's an outside lien with a credit union, The I is the products, the protection products that are offered associated with the transaction. And so JM&A provides the I from a product perspective, but from a holistic perspective, we marry the two together to bring the best of finance and how to optimize the finance aspect of the transaction with the appropriate products that meet the consumer's needs. And so the best process is going to start with early management intervention, with definition, with manager involvement that yields information sharing, trust transfer from the sales associate, and then ultimately to a tailored, authentic presentation to the consumer. That is the best process.
This episode is brought to you by my very own Car Dealership Guy industry job board. CDGjobs.com, my industry job board connecting the best talent in automotive with the best companies, will remain absolutely free for CDG listeners to post and fill available roles at their companies. This free job board is for anyone in automotive, vendors, dealers, lenders, manufacturers, auto tech, everyone. Already, over 100 companies have posted open positions, including Lithia Motors, Recurrent, Credit Acceptance, Viros Credit, Cars Commerce, Shift Digital, Plug, Fullpath, Westlake, Trade Pending. You get the point. The best part is that when these companies hire through cdgjobs.com, they are hiring the most informed candidates in the marketplace. So don't hesitate. You can add your open roles today by visiting cdgjobs.com or clicking the link in the show notes below. That's cdgjobs.com.
Let's just say I'm an alien right now. I just fell on Earth. Okay? I see you and I ask you, Scott, why do we need an F&I manager? Literally that simple, right? Explain to me. And again, I'm obviously asking this rhetorically because I have my own opinion, but I want to know your opinion. Why do we need F&I managers?
I think we need F&I managers because there's a lot of complexity associated with a customer's credit profile, the lending profile that banks offer, the specific vehicle that they're buying, and the specific needs of that consumer when it comes to product and protection to ensure that the transaction is done in a manner that's authentically tailored to that individual. Is the payment the right payment? Is the advance the right advance on the vehicle? Is the products the right products based on their desire for budget, how many miles they drive the vehicle, you know, how long they plan on owning the vehicle? So the F&I manager plays the role of all of that. So you're compliance, you're a lending expert, you're a vehicle expert, you're a product expert, you need to be some version of a people expert, and you need to do all this in a timely manner in order to consummate a deal for a dealer. That's why the F&I role is critically important.
Do you think that it's just a derivative of the dealership model, right? Like, meaning if I was a, if I'm a, cons- now I was an alien before, now I'm a consumer. If I'm a consumer listening to this and I say, well, I bought a new car from Tesla and I bought a used car from Carvana and there was no F&I manager. Is it the F&I manager, that role is critical because of the dealership model? Or is it, no. You know, Tesla and Carvana, they do it differently. What's your opinion on that?
So I believe in optionality. I believe if we give people the choice to transact the way they want to transact, if you want to do it completely digitally in the Tesla or Carvana model, great. If you want to do it completely digitally with some human involvement, i.e. like a virtual F&I, some virtual support in some co-pilot scenario, or if you want to do it completely online in store or completely in store, I believe that when in the consuming environment we're in today, we need to provide our consumers the most options so they have the right to pick what they want. I am not critical of Tesla or Carvana for doing it their way because I got to tell you, they've done a nice job. What they've been able to do is they've been able to take a lot of the human elements and replicate them in a process without human involvement. We've been able to do similar with our dealers. But if you look at a lot of the data that's out there today, so CarMax is a partner of ours. And I remember I should be very specific here. I think it was their third quarter earnings, I think last year, where, you know, we're talking about their online engagement. I think it's 8 to 10% of their customers completely buy online. They have all the capability and 8 to 10% buy online. I think when you look at the up and coming consumer generation, Cox and some of the other studies, I think CDK has done, that generation is actually preferring more in-person interaction than what we saw in the millennial generation from a data perspective. And so I go back to looking at the data and just, I believe the more options you give to consumers, the better you'll be. And I think when F&I managers are involved, or when humans are involved, they dramatically help the consumer in education and decisioning around what's best for them.
Mm-hmm. So you are obviously one of the market leaders with F&I products and, you know, many other services, but what are you doing then to meet the modern needs and desires of the consumers? You mentioned that you're working with dealers to offer, you know, more virtual solutions and sort of meet the customer where they're at. So what are you doing on your end? How are you actually solving this challenge?
So I would say let's start with virtual. You know, virtual F&I is something that we've been the purveyor of, that we launched well before COVID in 2016, end of 2016. We've done 34,000 deals now through virtual. Virtual comes with two different, one's an on-demand model where we have associates located all across the country that virtually connect into a dealership. The transaction is passed to them and they administer the F&I portion of the transaction. The other model is a centralized model where we take dealerships with multiple locations. And what we do is we enable the capability for locations to support transactions in other locations. So you don't have to be physically present. And we've learned a lot through this process. But for us, that goes back to the optionality for the consumer, is that we want to provide consumers the ability to have human interaction the way they want it. And so there's that. There's also a scale component. A lot of the challenges that we deal with today in the industry is that when dealerships are overrun with a lot of deals at one point in time, someone doesn't show up one day, they do a certain amount of volume that doesn't require two managers, maybe it's one and a half, virtual can fill that gap. So that's a big strategy for us in engaging the consumer and for the dealer today. I'll pause there because there's others, but I don't know if there's any questions you have.
Well, I want to ask you, I hear the word virtual, and I ask myself, how would I feel if I was a F&I manager for 20 years? And I'm curious behind the scenes, right? What is it like as the world is transitioning? Things are becoming more virtual, digital. What's happening from your perspective? What are you seeing behind the scenes? Is there friction between, you know, management and F&I managers, right? Like, do F&I managers not want to adopt these tools and GMs do? What's happening there?
So I would say, yeah. I mean, I think there's always, yes, there's friction. I think some of the friction is just rooted in change. I think just adults struggle with change. And so a lot of the friction just comes with really understanding the individual's resistance and trying to overcome that resistance. That's been a lot of our journey. A lot of our journey has really been focused on that, on the change management aspect of it. Dealers, you know, the value prop is strong for virtual capabilities. And it's, so it's not convincing the dealer. It's really getting the dealership associates on board. Interestingly enough, we have one of our large customers that is undergoing a 30-store, I don't even want to call pilot, but I would say transition this year, where they're going to have virtual capabilities in 30 stores. Some of those 30 stores might not even have F&I managers physically present on site. Some of them are those scenarios where they need half of an F&I manager and we'll cover. In order to hire personnel for the dealership, this group went out and pulled some of the F&I forums to say, what do you think about the thought of working from home and being an F&I manager? And we got overwhelming positive reactions about, wait, you can give me flexibility. I could work from home and I can do this. Certainly COVID helped that. So sometimes maybe it's better to be lucky than good. COVID was certainly a buoy to that. But what we're finding is more open-mindedness around personnel, that there's some creature comforts that come with it. But they're, I think they're also seeing, as we've got more and more transactions happening, consumer reaction is strong. And it's not that different to be on camera as is versus in person, getting people comfortable with that. So we're as booked as we've been since we launched this right now and kicking off different relationships with this capability. And so I would say that, again, just full circle, the human resistance is big. The technological hurdles are small. And listen, it's not fail-proof. The technology is not fail-proof. I mean, there is some stitching together of capabilities, But what we're finding is, you know, people are more digitally savvy today, and they're becoming more open-minded just because of the world around them. And so they can adopt the digital capabilities pretty quickly.
So on that note, transitioning to, I just want to talk about some profits and actual numbers, right? What are you seeing right now? Give us some averages when it comes to F&I, when it comes to products, when it comes to, you know, what we call back end. What are some margins you're seeing across the board?
So when we look at our average, and I'm talking, you know, a substantial number of dealers across the country, we do business in all 50 states in North America. We do business in Hawaii, Alaska, Puerto Rico. So all dealers are represented in this subset. The numbers we're seeing on average are between $1,900 and $2,000 a car in PVR. And again, that's an average.
And that's only, you say, profit per vehicle only on the F&I, not the vehicle itself.
That's purely what we would call back-end gross profit. Back-end in the dealership is F&I specific. Front-end is the margin you make purely on the vehicle itself. There's no margin associated with the lending or product sale. So this is purely on the lending and product sale portion of the transaction. And specific to that, I want to give you a little context because depending upon the geography where you are, the brand you represent, the finance penetration in your dealership, and the leasing penetration in your dealership are all key inputs to that number. So at an average between 1900 and 2000, obviously there's people higher and there's people lower. There's people that will listen to this and say, you're only running 2000 a car, you're not very good. There's other people that would say, you're running 2000 a car, how the heck are you doing that? So, I mean, again, it's an average that go back to those inputs that drive that outcome.
Well, it makes me wonder if that's the average, which that is the average, right? I'm familiar with that number. Who are the dealerships that are making $1,000 on the back end? And what is different about those dealerships? What are they doing differently?
I would say what we tend to find is different is usually everything points to process. We have a group of specialists here at JM&A that go into dealerships. And when they go into dealership and we look at kickoffs, so new relationships, and what our specialists are designed to be is they are product process zealots for us. They only know to follow the process and we gauge them based on process adherence. There's an average swing when our specialists go in the store and leave of about $300 per car, which was $300 better from where they were versus where they left. And that's an average number. And so what I would say generally is the difference is there's a process issue is where to start. Then you go to compensation. Are the pay plans and incentives aligned with the outcome that's being desired? I would go to manager buy-in. So do we have the right support from the dealer, the general manager, whatever the structure is? And then finally, I would look at, do we have the right people? So one of those areas tends to be the root cause of why someone is not performing. Process is always consistent across all of these. And you might have process or not might. You have process plus, 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 or just plus for that matter of some other root cause.
Yeah, I love how I can just tell, like, you guys are so surgical about this, right? It's like everything, you have like a list of like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, and it's start, yeah.
It's, you've sort of kind of, the science is down. It just follow this. I love that. So digging one level deeper into the back end, right? From a product perspective, most profitable products, least profitable products.
So the most profitable product is a service contract. And it's also the most costly product. And it is the most common product. And so, you know, the balance of our portfolio is derived off of service contracts at JM&A. Least profitable product is probably going to be a prepaid maintenance product. And the reason why is because it's designed for retention. So the profit on prepaid maintenance is often realized through RO upsells in the service department versus F&I office profitability.
Which arguably I could make the case that maybe it's even more profitable.
It is.
It's just a longer time horizon to recoup that profit.
That's 100% right. And so it's just a matter of where the profit's coming in the dealership. We do RO analysis where we go look at ROs and compare ROs for customers that had a prepaid maintenance or car care is what we refer to it as, and ones that didn't. And the, you know, hours per RO, dollars per RO are higher on average in a lot of cases. Sense. significantly higher. But the value of, even if that wasn't the case, there's a lot of quantification, and I follow you, and you are very curious about a lot of information, and you've referenced it. Frequency of visits to a dealership yield to more overall profitability. So just getting them back to the store, there's a greater propensity of them coming back more, buying more, et cetera. So there's value in that. That's more qualitative.
Are you seeing anything from like a changing consumer preferences when it comes to products purchased, bought, even interested in? Is there some sleeper product that's like rising or something like that?
You know, it's interesting. This is probably one of the more common questions that I get. And it's, you know, when you, and I'm going to digress for a second, but in this frame is that one of the biggest questions I'm asked from like my leadership at JM Fam is like, what's the next innovative product you're going to build? Or, you know, and I'm asking of our team, like, and the reality is that innovation comes with incrementality is the way I see it. Like there's not this revolutionary product.
No silver bullet. No silver bullet. Just keep the reps going.
I've burned a lot of money, calories, hair, and everything trying to find it, but it's all incrementality. So no, I wouldn't say that there's this new fledgling demand that we're seeing from consumers on some product. Now, I will say there's areas of interest in the EV space that, you know, a lot of customers, when there's any new offering in the market, i.e. an EV is a new powertrain that consumers aren't as familiar with, it comes with doubt. So there's a lot of curiosity around, you know, how do our products cover EV? Because as you know, the EV manufacturers have very long coverage when it comes to the battery and pretty long coverage when it comes to just the overall vehicle outside of the battery. So there's some interest. Knowing that EVs, I'll just stay in that vein today. And I know it's a low percentage of overall sales today, but it's a high area of interest that, you know, we're dealing with. It's also around the retention products, you know, because you're not covering in a prepaid maintenance oil changes. So, you know, tires wear quicker. You might have saw, you know, Automotive News, I think, had a study the other day. I saw in the headline that, you know, consumers aren't as happy with how quickly the tires are wearing on EVs because they're heavier vehicles. So having to get creative around, you know, what's the makeup of some of the products for those vehicles? I would say set aside that economic trends drive consumer interest as well. So last year in September, I believe it was September, Automotive News published a study that some two former Fed Reserve associates and one Mississippi State University professor did, and they were looking at the viability of F&I products. And as part of the study, I think there was 1,200 people that were surveyed in the study. 39% of them came back and said, I cannot afford a $500 repair. If I had a $500 repair on my vehicle today, the vehicle would have to sit. And so economic trends drive that behavior. So we're seeing interest in service contract, which is always interest, but we're seeing that interest because today it's a matter of if I have one payment on a monthly basis and I know that payment will protect me from mechanical breakdown in the event I'm out of warranty coverage from the manufacturer, gap coverage today, you know, gap is, and I know that's an industry term, but really just a quick explanation, it covers the difference between what you owe on the vehicle to the lender versus what the actual value of the vehicle is from a, you know, market perspective. And as negative equity enters back into the market at a more rampant pace than what we've seen the last couple of years, that product is gaining in popularity as well.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I think in general, I'll give you like my bet. It's that I think general, in like the insurance side here, insurance products, the point I'm trying to make is that here, let me take you back, right?
Protection products, I would tell you. Yeah.
Protection, right? Yeah. Like I think again, CDK, I think put out a report on Gen Z buying habits and how they are like much more risk averse in their purchase. And it just makes you wonder. And by the way, Gen Z, surprisingly to many people, are buying cars more than millennials were even at their age. Needless to say, I mean, a lot of these cars are being paid by the parents, but the point is they are buying cars. They have an interest in, you know, having a vehicle. And so it just makes me wonder, right, things that like a risk-averse generation will be buying more or potentially want more products to de-risk vehicle ownership. So it sort of feels like that is the right trend to follow as you think about the future. So that's my, you know, that's my too cheap two cents on that.
No, I appreciate the validation, and I agree with you. And I think I go back to, I think that CDK study was a similar study where Gen Z wanted more human interaction and physical presence. So it's interesting because, you know, in our world, in life, we go through these hype curves. And I don't know how familiar you are with hype curves, but the beginning of a hype curve is this huge mountain of
I'm on Twitter all day. I got to know what a hype curve is.
Yeah. But then there's this trough of disillusionment, right? And the trough like drops way below where they were even at the starting point. And the reason I share that with you is because, you know, people tend to adopt these bold strategies like autonomous. Nobody's going to be driving cars in the future, or every vehicle is going to be EV on the road in the future, or every customer is going to want to buy online. And it doesn't work that way. So it's just interesting with this generation. It's a great lesson for us because they're behaving very different than the previous generation. But when the previous generation was the only generation, we were assuming that was the way of the future. And the reason I share that is because in our business, we have to be very open-minded to support all consumers and all dealers, and no matter which way they see the world. And it's a moving target.
So on that note, speaking of hype, AI is a massive, massive talk of the town here. Where are we at on the AI hype curve specific to automotive?
Interesting. I'm going to give you an opinion. There could be some disagreement around my opinion, which I'm open to. I don't think there's as much hype in automotive as there is in other places around AI. I would start there. I'm not suggesting there's not hype, but I think that there's a curious, the interaction I have with consumers. We've looked at AI companies for partnership, for investment. I have dealer partners that are invested in AI companies. We're using AI internally, and I can talk about that in a second for us. But what I've generally found is this is interesting to help me solve problems, but I haven't talked to as many people in the industry that are feel incredibly threatened by it, nor are they overly excited that, you know, they have to change everything in their dealership today to align to it, which is interesting because I think there's other businesses that I've read about that's just a little bit of a different reaction there. But AI, you know, it's interesting. Florida, in the most recent legislative session that just ended a couple of weeks ago, passed more regulation around AI, which is coming in many other states. And part of this regulation is that consumers now have to be made aware when they're interacting with an AI mechanism versus a human.
Like a chatbot or something like that?
Yeah. So, and we're trying to read through all the legalese associated with, but the headline is that, you know, so if you think about the hype around AI, there's a lot of regulation that's trying to catch up. There's a lot of proving out. I mean, we're using AI today. We're using AI in a lot of areas in our claims function. And listen, we're experiencing hallucination on the AI front. We're experiencing all the same challenges that are out there. But we have a very optimistic, open mind that there's a lot of problems that it could help us solve. And we're also looking at there's a lot of human enablement that it could help us with as well. So I think the automotive is taking a paced approach towards the acceptance and understanding of AI.
I don't think your take is controversial at all, actually. I think relative to other industries, I would agree with you that, it doesn't surprise me, right? It's auto. We're not Silicon Valley. And so I'm following it. I'm curious to see how it evolves with the different SaaS products and what impact it really has in the dealership. TBD, how it's going to scale. There's definitely some players, Impel, Fullpath, they're partners of this podcast, and they're doing a lot of work on the AI front. You know, their CEOs are some of the most knowledgeable people I've spoken with when it comes to just AI advancement. And so we'll be keeping very close tabs on that.
I would agree with you too. There's a lot of advancement happening. I mean, I've seen in the fixed ops space some really neat capability that AI is bringing. From just a retention of consumers when looking at the data and looking at the propensity need for service. I mean, there's a lot of neat use cases out there. And so I think there's momentum happening. And I agree, there's some very smart people that you're referencing and others that I'm bullish about bringing solutions that are going to help us evolve the business.
Yeah, I have Jim Roche from OrCloud coming on the pod.
Do you really?
I'll ask him. I'll bring that up and we'll see what he says about that.
We've had many discussions with Jim and his team. So yeah, smart guy.
Great company. I want to transition to the market, right? So moving away from F&I for a second. I think the other thing that I found very interesting about your company is just the fact that, again, you have a lot of data, whether it's always publicly available or not, whether it hits my direct messages, wink, wink, or not, you have a lot of really great data. And so I want to know from you, give us an overview of what you're seeing in the market right now and specifically where we're headed to next.
Yeah, we do have a treasure trove of data. I'll give you some vantage points in the market. So one, I'm going to start with fixed operations. You know, what we've seen is a dramatic acceleration of labor rate growth and parts cost growth over the last several years. Auto maintenance and repair inflation was tracking middle of last year at nearly 4 times what core inflation was tracking. And that has since come down. I think there's about a 2% spread between the two right now in the latest data I have. But what we've seen is just the cost of repair and maintenance come up significantly. So that's a trend that, you know, we're paying very close attention to. The other trend, or trends, I should say, we're paying attention to is obviously cost of funds. So, you know, we have over 200 basis points of average cost of funds in our portfolio year over year. We're looking at vehicle, both purchase price, so transaction price, and just overall vehicle price. So transaction price obviously is inclusive of negative equity on the trade, other things, but just the pure vehicle escalation in price. And so from a data perspective, all-time highs in both transaction price and in vehicle price. And so, you know, we're seeing this mounting cost growth, and that's a pretty significant trend. And
wait, I want to ask you though, when you say transaction price, you're talking about vehicle transaction price, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Right, okay. Right.
But it's also the price of the car, one piece, plus price of financing, if there's negative equity, all those things. So both.
Do you think that dealerships are significantly risking the loyalty of the service customer, right? Like, do you think this could get to a point where, I mean, we're already seeing a higher percentage of consumers, Cox Automotive put out this data, that a higher percentage of consumers are going to third-party shops because of prices. So do you think that this is, again, an increasing risk for dealerships? I mean, does it have to go back? What's your take on this?
I do think there's a risk there. It's really, really, really a unique problem. And I'll say this because dealers make tremendous investments in their facilities, in the infrastructure, the technology that's required today to support these. I mean, you know, all of the infrastructure that's gone on over the last couple of years to prepare for EVs, new lifts, charging infrastructure, power. You know, there's been a lot of investment, and dealers are business people, and they need to get a return on that investment. So I can't fault the reality of needing to get the return. I think what the risk is that we got to pay close attention, because there's a point of elasticity here on pricing. There's absolutely a point of elasticity. And I think what dealers need to do is really look at their market and understand the defection and understand, you know, what is the derivative of defection? Is it price, or is it price plus other things? Because what we have a lot of data that sees is that if the process and the consumer experience is world class to fit a lot of the facilities and a lot of the investment that's made, consumers will pay more. But a lot of what you find about these independent repair shops is the convenience component of it. It's easy to get to. And it's, you know, they might not be as busy, and they have a reputation of being less in cost. I could tell you, I'm not suggesting on the surface they're not less in cost, but they make pretty decent margin in those businesses as well. So, you know, they're making money, and they've branded a reputation associated with them being a cost leader in doing that. But I always believe in the incumbent at the dealer level as the greatest propensity to change this. And I think it's a myriad of things, pricing being one, that we have to dig into the root cause and understand. And I really believe firmly, and if you solve the consumer experience and the time component of it, there's a great propensity to offset some of the defection that exists and to sustain pricing.
Great. Well said. So before we wrap up, I want to transition to trends in the market. And, you know, we spoke about specific F&I trends and you gave us an overview of where you believe the market's headed. Is there anything else you're paying attention to right now, right? Like what's a day or a week or a month in the life? I know that's a big difference, by the way, from a day to a week and a month. But like what's going through your head right now? Is there anything keeping you up at night?
So I would say yes. I'm just naturally not a great sleeper. So the propensity to be up at night is high for me, whether it's a noise in the house or it's what's going on in the retail
world. Scott, if it makes you feel better, my daughter woke up at 4 a.m. last night and thought it was the morning. She thought it was the morning. You're like, that's it. I'm up. And so we had to start explaining to her, convincing her that it's not the morning until she fell back asleep. So that was my morning. Anyways, back to you.
My best friend had a son 4 months before I did. And he lied to me for 4 months about what the experience was like, because there's no way to prepare for lack of sleep, you know? So, in any event, I sympathize with you with two children. But I would go back and say the things that keep me up at night is the first is the consumer, is that, you know, I believe in a capitalistic market that exists in the world that we're in today, the consumer has the ultimate purchase power. And the more we have to continue to understand the consumer and be flexible and agile to their needs. I mean, I absolutely think, and the consumer's a moving target, as we talked about the difference between the millennial generation and Gen Z. And so there's not a one size fits all. And I think for dealers, there's other industries that are moving faster than we are that we have to glean insights from. And we have to understand, you know, how do those insights apply to our business? So that's one. Two is technology. There's still a lot of fragmentation in the dealership space. The, you know, what the consumer is using online versus the process in store, there's still too much separation that exists. And I think we have to bridge that gap. I think we have to give the consumer benefit for the research that they're doing. We have to give them benefit to their interests, and we have to really create customized, authentic processes for one. And everyone is different. And that's tough. Because I can tell you, we're the process company, you know, process efficiency, effectiveness. But what we preach a lot around here is there's thought tracks. Let's teach people how to think. And then if I can teach you how to think, and then you could apply those thoughts yourself, you can then ask effective questions and you can get a person to the same outcome in different channels. So I would say that's the second thing. The third thing is, you know, the regulatory space. There's, I don't know, more impending regulation right now than I'm aware of in my history of being in this business for 25 years. So it's, and what I would say is that regulation's a moving target. So a lot of times there's a lot of interpretation. So if you think of the proposed CARS rule right now, you know, specific to us, you know, the basic fundamentals of consumer optionality, consumer awareness. So they know they have the option. They're aware of what they're buying and they've authorized the purchase through acknowledgement. It's a basic. The reality is we know about our business that there's people that don't like it. Now, you could argue about, you know, how much concern is out there and that in, you know, that's inputting to the regulators to take action. But the reality is we know. I mean, we read studies about our business. And so I think
just look at my Twitter feed and look at the comments and you'll see, you'll get a big sample size right there.
So I think what we have to figure out is going back to the consumer is how do we perfect the process without somebody telling us that you have to do it this way? So regulation concerns me because I think that a lot of times regulation is well-intended, but it's not always all-encompassing of the reality. Car dealers are some of the best businessmen and women that I've ever met. They make tremendous investments in their business. The cash flow in this business is astounding about how much money you have to lay out in order to do just one transaction and multiply that by hundreds a month. So I think we have to be very smart, pay attention to where the regulators are, understand the regulation, but really just perfect the consumer that keeps me up at night. And I guess one more, and I is just future generations. I mean, the workforce birth rates are down, as we've seen over the last several years, and the attraction to the workforce is tougher. It's not just for the car business. Not a lot of people, you know, go home and say, "Mom and Dad, I'm getting in the car business," and they get high-fived. You know, not a lot of people desire to get in this business. And so I think we have to continue to rebrand ourselves to be a more desirable place. Because I can tell you, I've learned more about life in this business and been afforded an unbelievable life as a result of this business. And there's so much that I think people in tough economic circumstances can learn and benefit from joining this business. We just got to make it enticing for them. And money's not the only enticement.
Well, when you say that, you know what comes to mind? I know you or JM Family did an investment in Rock Ed, who's a, you know, he's a friend of ours. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I had one of the topics I wanted to hit on with you, which you just addressed, is really like the future and like attracting talent to automotive and what needs to be done. And so I think, and obviously, right, I'm putting my money where my mouth is, right? I think overall changing the media landscape of auto, I believe, can uplift it for consumers and dealers together, which is why everything I do is, it's democratized, right? Like my stuff, I write something, it goes out to, you know, millions of people across the web, of which there's a percentage who are in our industry or involved in our industry, but there's many that are not. And it's cool because you get to kind of share that stuff transparently and, you know, make it, share it hopefully as objectively as possible to kind of bring both sides together. At least that's how I envision it. But great way to wrap up the conversation, because that is actually what was going through my head. It's like, what is the next generation for automotive? What does that look like? And how do you actually help create better trained, better individuals in this industry?
And I mean, there's Rock Ed. I mean, there's the hypothesis for Rock Ed right there, is that Rock Ed has, it's kind of like TikTok for training. It's got these digital capabilities that is embracing the way humans are communicating and interacting today. And let's give them that opportunity.
Hey, dude, this is so much fun. I really enjoyed it. A lot of great insight. I love how, and I could just tell you're like a process guy. Because, and you know, it's funny, like, I feel like in certain parts in life, I'm super process driven, and other parts, it's like a mess, like me, my brain, the way it works. But it's always funny when you're having a conversation with someone, and like you gave me a lot of lists, like 1, 2, 3.
I think
I think the same way. It's just like a way of thinking that makes things easy to understand, right? It's like, here's the thing, 1, 2, 3, da, da, da. And like, I love that. So well done on that, because you make it very easy to digest information. And I think listeners will really appreciate that. So Scott, thanks for coming on. This has been awesome.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Please give the podcast a rating, consider subscribing to the show, and check the show notes for links to what we talked about. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you guys next time.